BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio. Dalek Radio is back on the air for the autumn. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, right by Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. We have our financial crisis correspondent, Martin Summers, talking about the latest crashes in the financial markets. We also talked to Bristolian Iraqi Sami Veliola, who's been working in Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Actor Malcolm Grieve continues from last week with another chapter of Sado is Rosie, and we hear part 7 of the history of theatre in Bristol, the history of the theatre in Bristol during World War I. I'm John Peters Coleman, and now over to Martin Summers for the latest on the credit crunch.
Could you introduce yourself and give us a brief resume of the latest developments in the what is now be called the credit crunch?
Hello, my name's Martin Summers. I used to be East European project worker for the New Economics Foundation in the 1990s, and I co-wrote a book about the economic transition in Eastern Europe. I'm currently not working in that field, but I still obviously have some knowledge. Obviously, in the last couple of days in particular, the credit crunch has really turned into an international financial crisis. Major organisations such as the mortgage lenders Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and the insurance group American International Group are now effectively bankrupt and being bailed out by the US taxpayer. This is unprecedented. Panic is spreading across stock markets around the world as we speak. Nobody's quite sure where the bottom of this is going to come.
And the Lehman Brothers investment bank has also gone bankrupt. Can you just explain what's the difference between an ordinary high street bank and an investment bank?
Well, that's one of the problems. In the past, investment banks, before the Glass-Steagall Act in the US was repealed in 1999, investment banks were separated from retail banks, the sort of banks that you and I might use, and that was a precautionary measure. The fundamental cause of the credit crisis is the deregulation of financial markets that happens from the 1980s onwards, which have progressively smoothed the differences between different kinds of financial operator, allowed everybody to branch out into the more weird and wacky end of modern financial innovation. And of course, this means that the mainstream credit system is now at risk from failures in what's called the shadow banking market. Most of the regulations were put in place from 1945 onwards to prevent this, 1930s and 1945 onwards to prevent this. They've been dismantled and now we're seeing the consequences.
So how is the ordinary person going to be affected by this in the near future, do you think? And because obviously most people don't have bank accounts with people like Lehman Brothers.
Well, if you own less than £30,000, I think it is, and you've got that in a bank account, that should be relatively safe because that's guaranteed by the government. The main way in which ordinary people are going to be affected by this is by a very vicious deflationary recession, which is going to deprive people of work, possibly then push them out of their houses, and of course their pensions, which are dependent upon stock market values, will also be devastated. So it's just hard times for ordinary people, which makes me not terribly worried about these bankers that are losing money at the moment. They're not, in fact, losing money. These bailouts and so on are leading to senior bankers walking away with millions, which I think people will come to regard as an absolute scandal as time proceeds.
Now, some have been saying that the Federal Reserve System that was created back in after the First World War, even around about the time of the First World War, was always going to lead to this kind of crisis. Would you agree with that? Or do you think that it's actually more of a sort of coincidence?
Well, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, and unlike other Western central banks, it's not in fact a government-owned institution. The rules of the Federal Reserve are that the biggest banks in each particular district basically make up the board of the bank. So it's a kind of bank of banks. The Bank of England was nationalised in 1946 in Britain. And one of the problems, therefore, is conflict of interest. The Federal Reserve, which ought to be there to police the private banks, is in fact owned by the private banks. And this leads to all kinds of bad decisions, including the deregulation decisions and probably some of the bailout decisions, whether to bail out or not to bail out, which are being taken. The decisions are being taken with the interests of the bankers paramount rather than the public interest paramount, and that's going to become increasingly apparent as well.
Another reason which is cited is the fact that the banks actually really don't have open books about where their investments are and how safe and secure those investments are. Do you think that's another contributory factor?
Well, I mean, people come up with this word transparency and so on, and there ought to be more transparency. But a lot of financial innovation has been geared around the idea of non-transparency. These things are so complicated that you can't understand them. And to a certain extent, confidentiality is part of banking. You know, you wouldn't want your personal details to be perused, and nor do many bigger investors.
No, but we're talking about whether the banks are actually exposed to larger institutions, not to private individuals.
Well, I mean, the fundamental problem is the creation of the shadow banking market. An awful lot of what goes on now, derivative swaps and all the rest of it, doesn't happen in the open marketplace. And that's why in the past these things were forbidden, because they weren't carried out as regulated trades. I think we're going to have to go back to a much smaller, more regulated stock market if we can get through this. But as George Soros was saying on Newsnight last night, that's a problem for the future. The problem we've got to face now is what the hell do we do about the immediate danger of a collapse of the financial system. They didn't rescue Lehman Brothers because they said, we're not going to rescue anybody else now, that's it, we're not rescuing anybody else, until AIG came along the next day and suddenly that was out the window. Now, this doesn't exactly instill confidence that people know what they're doing or why they're doing it.
Why haven't the financial regulators in Britain and America and other parts of the Western world prepared for this? Surely this is the one thing that they would, through most of their life at the last 10, 20 years, have been making sure that things like this credit crunch couldn't happen.
I think that the regulators were basically told to lay off by the politicians, and the politicians were doing what they'd been told by the bankers who were lobbying them behind the scenes and giving big donations to the political campaigns of the politicians. So, and they're certainly in the US. So the regulators basically didn't bother to chase up all of these things. And they thought that somehow the capitalist system as currently constituted would look after itself. That was the ideology. We don't need regulation. It'll all be sorted out through market mechanisms. But of course, that's all been blown out of the water by the rescues of big institutions that have been going bust. If you're going to follow a strict market model, shouldn't rescue any of them. But then they've been rescuing the financial system since Mexico defaulted in 1982 with government money. So there's a big delusion at the heart of modern capitalism, the delusion being that the private sector is supreme, when in actual fact the whole banking system has been underpinned by state intervention. It's just that the state doesn't actually act in the public interest, because if they were to do so, then they would probably have to liquidate an awful lot of private banks and we'd have a quite different looking system.
So do you think the scales are falling from our eyes now of the so-called financial marketplace?
I think that's exactly what's happening, but the problem is that the damage that's being done is enormous, because the amounts of money which are being ponied up to rescue all of these failing institutions is actually yours and my money further down the line. It's taxpayer money. I was reading something earlier that suggests that with the losses just so far in Britain, we're talking about an increase of 5p in the pound in income tax or a cut of 20 billion in public services in order to cover the interest payments on the liabilities that the government has undertaken. In the long run, I think people are going to be extremely angry about that, because we're effectively rescuing bankrupt institutions at our children's and our grandchildren's expense.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Thank you very much to Martin Summers for that. Matt Heap has been away from the studio for a while, but he's back with us tonight and he's giving us his own personal Matt's Muses.
Thank you, John. This year, NASA is celebrating its 50th anniversary, but in half a century of images, one in particular stands out. It's the 1968 Apollo 8 photograph of Earth Rise, and it shows the Earth as a beautiful blue sphere suspended in the black void of space. For many people, it sums up why we're spending so much money on space exploration. Our home may look beautiful, but it also looks small, and it makes us realise how alone we are. It won't be long before planet Earth can no longer support us. In a few days' time, the first Chinese astronaut will be having the same view, and he will be wearing an £8 million suit whilst he does so. He's going to be spending 14 minutes floating in space outside his spacecraft. Well, I guess you would insist on the best spacesuit if you were floating in a vacuum at stupidly cold temperatures. Apart from the Earthrise picture looking amazing, it is a further proof of what Aristotle worked out more than 2,000 years ago, that the Earth is in fact a sphere. Despite this overwhelming evidence, it seems that there are still people who refuse to believe that the Earth is anything other than flat. Yes, these people do exist, and they're called flat earthers. Mr. Davis, a computer scientist from Canada, is one such person. He thinks the whole thing is a conspiracy invented by the space agencies of the world to dupe the public for vast profit. But what about those pictures? Fake, he says. How about the fact that no one has ever fallen off the edge of the Earth? He gets asked that question all the time. Flat Earth theorists say the North Pole is at the centre of the disk, whilst the Antarctic surrounds its edge, so that when we travel around the world, it's presumably like moving in a circle around a flat object like a plate. Even Mr. Sulu from Star Trek knows that the Earth is round. How old do you reckon Mr. Sulu is now? Well, he's 71, actually, and he's just got married in one of California's first same-sex marriages. His partner's 54. They weren't wearing £8 million suits, just matching white tuxedos. It's crazy when you think about all the money they've spent on space exploration, but some useful stuff has come out of it, I suppose. For example, satellites. Where would we be without satellites? Well, no satellite TV, no sat-nav. Sat-nav's already well, but where does it get us, really? It's been known to send the odd articulated lorry under a low bridge. I guess if you're a London cabbie, you don't need sat-nav. Well, maybe they use them now, but you've got the knowledge, which is the encyclopedic knowledge of all London streets. It's quite impressive, really. Must be some crazy exam that you have to pass to become a London cabbie. Unlike the girls involved in a recent mass fainting fit at a Tanzanian school, apparently the first time they saw their final year paper, there was mass hysteria, chaos and crying, screaming, and some people ran out of the room. It's hard to imagine London cabbies having that same reaction to their exams. It's just probably just as well. With more and more cyclists on the road, those taxi drivers must really be getting wound up. Apparently, one in five of us are cycling to work now, rather than the one in 20, which employers still use as a rough ratio to calculate how many bike racks to supply. Needless to say, there's lots of cyclists having trouble finding places to lock their bike, and one cyclist in London got so frustrated by a sign warning him off the railings that he began to lock random objects to the railings, such as kettles, frying pans, ironing boards and fridge doors, just to get his point across. Of course, it's always annoying when somebody else accidentally locks their bike to yours. Beware, though, that some thieves actually do this on purpose, so that they can return under the cover of night just to steal your bike in peace and quiet. All this cycling is very good for the environment, that and the use of low-energy light bulbs. Most of us are converted now, but there are a few people still trying to hoard the old ones as they disappear from the shops. They complain about the lights not being bright enough and making a buzzing noise and taking too long to switch on. Apparently, if you break one of these low-energy light bulbs, you have to leave the room for 15 minutes. and when you return, you've got to double bag the remains wearing gloves and then return it to the council. It's because of the mercury. I did some research on this and I found out that there is less mercury inside each bulb than would be emitted by a coal-fired power station producing the extra electricity needed to power a traditional bulb in its place. I'm personally going to swap all my light bulbs for low energy ones at home. It's a bit of a nightmare because we've got dimmer switches. That means they don't work with low energy bulbs. Saving money is becoming more important to all of us, I guess, and saving the environment. What do you think is the least amount of money you could get by spending on a day, excluding rent and bills? Well, there's this teacher from Bristol who reckons that she can get by on £1 a day. And the way she's done this is to go to car boot sales and eat at free buffets every day. So she's eating at a free buffet every day. Seems unlikely. She's probably just scoffing at all her flatmates' food. I wonder what that Chinese astronaut would have thought of her frugality. What if we sold that spacesuit and gave the teacher the £8 million? I calculated that she could keep 3,171 people alive for 70 years using her £1 a day scheme. Still, it's not exactly as fun as looking at the Earth from outer space, I guess. Back to you, John.
Well, thank you very much, Matthew. That was a real stream of consciousness from an encyclopedia of topic news. Now time for a track from a local lass.
They say that everything can be replaced, yet every distance is not near. Yet I remember every face of every man that put me here. I see my light come shining from the west down to the
That was Bristol's very own Beth Rowley singing Everything Can Be Replaced. Our Tony Gosling interviewed a Bristolian Iraqi gentleman named Sami Veliola, and he's been recently working in Kirkuk, which is in northern Iraq.
One of the guys who came to me to say, look, I'm ready to speak to you, but if you want, you can actually, if you can get somebody to give you immunity to take me abroad, and I live there, I take a refuge there somewhere, because if this word gets out here, they kill me. He was working in the first mobile communication company, ASSL, in Iraq. He works, let's say, the distance between Bristol and Bath. He works in a city just outside Kirkuk. He's a driver. He takes the people into work, and after hours, he brings them back into Kirkuk. The US Army, convoy of them, they stopped this about 10 cars on the way. They had... they got the people out of the cars about 100 meters away, told them to keep their face away from the car, from their vehicles, while they carry out a search. So they sat down with their hands up, searched their vehicles, and then after about 10 minutes they said to them, right, it's nothing, 10-15 minutes, you can go back to your cars, you're clear to go. Then what happened is, when the guys, this is a minibus, the guys went back to their vehicles, and this guy went to drive the car. One of the passengers said, well, my seat is not right, it's moving a bit, can you straighten it or something? He came down and he's looking at the seat, which is not pushed down properly, one of those lifting seats. And he lifted the seat, loads of explosives underneath the seat. And he's like, what's happening? They came to search their vehicles, and after that, the explosives inside the car. So they take off and they dump, there's a river further down the road, they dump the explosives there, and he's scared for his life. He thinks those people, they'll be transported from the branch to the headquarters of the communication. So this vehicle would have been in that destination. When he arrives there, they would have triggered and blown it up. And the other incident was a police lieutenant. I was in that area, a specific area, that people, there's a petrol station further ahead, and those people, they are refusing to join the queue, they're trying to cheat. The Americans, they've taken about six or seven cars in a convoy, Hummers behind and Hummers ahead, and they're going, supposedly they are committed offense, and they're going to, trying to put them straight, you know. So they come to this area where I was in. One of the vehicles breaks down. And the American soldier gets out with the driver. They push the vehicle to the roadside. And in that road, it's a very busy road. They don't allow vehicles to stop there, unless they know the owner where it is and if he's got a shop there or something like that. So not long after that, the police, they came, Iraqi police. Who's the owner of this car? Who's the owner of this car? Nobody can find the owner. So immediately they try to break the window of the car to search it. I came to the lieutenant. I said to him, I said, listen, officer, I said, the driver, has been taken by the Americans. So no need to smash or vandalize. Obviously the car broke down, I saw that. And they've taken the driver. I said, listen, my brother, I'm not trying to be horrible, but let me tell you something. Do you think the Americans are trustworthy? How would I know? They haven't agreed with this guy, or they've taken him somewhere else and they booby-trapped his car and they brought him here. I can't trust that. So he called the headquarters. He said, this is my patch, this area. I do not want this vehicle, whether the Americans, whether the Israelis, anybody. I don't care whether the Iraqi government. I don't care. This car will be lifted from there, taken somewhere else. So I have no trust in no Americans, no one. I only trust my instinct. This car was dumped. I don't know what they've done to the car. When it explodes, it's my responsibility.
Now, there was a famous incident earlier in the year where the British actually went in and took some SAS people, what's believed to be SAS people, who had been arrested by the Iraqi police. Do you know anything about that incident? Because I think we remember it was over a couple of days in the news here. It was a very strange thing because, first of all, the Iraqi police arrested them, mm-hmm. And then the British then came and actually attacked a house where he was being kept, smashed through the wall, and got these people out. So what was all that about? What can you explain?
Because there was a roadblock by the police. And this dressed in civilian SAS workers or soldiers, they tried to push their way. Iraqi police open fire. Not only they're civilians, so they don't have something written on their forehead or something. You know, we're agents or we're working with the British Army. So they open fire on them. When they stopped, they've tried to clear their way to say, open the road for us, and I don't know what means and what they communicated with them. But when they refused, the Iraqi police refused, they opened fire and killed one of them, I think, at least. And then they shot off in their vehicles. Their vehicles are off-road vehicles as well, so they can take over any obstacles on the way. So they took off. Eventually, the Iraqi police caught up with them and arrested them, because of number of them, obviously. They took them to a prison in Basra, where British Army, that night, they decided, or that day, that night, they decided they're going to drive the tank, reverse into the police station, and free them from the cells. And I don't think they were subjected to any trial or any form of questions or anything like that. They just did it. So what makes you think who gives right to anybody to license to kill, you know, in the 21st century? We have a license to kill. So that's all right, you're an American soldier or American officer, or you're a British soldier, British officer, and you can go to Iraq, you can kill, and you have no questions to answer. Obviously, that is double standard, you know. If somebody takes the life of someone, they should at least be responsible to answer some questions. Why and what motive made you do that?
Let's talk about you a bit, Sammy. How come you're in Bristol, and what are you up to in Iraq?
Well, I'm Iraqi British, from Iraqi background. I've lived about 50% of my life in Iraq, and the other 50% in Britain. So, first, this incident, when they were determined to start the war in Iraq, supposedly to liberate Iraq from Saddam's regime, as they say, I knew something horrible was going to happen. I knew there will be a lot of casualties over there, and people are going to need some help. And I thought instinctively, like, to go with a group of friends that they are helping me in Bristol to go and collect aid and medicine and medicine.
Well, thank you to Tony Gosling, and thank you to Sammy Veliola, a half-Iraqi and half-British gentleman from Bristol. He organises a humanitarian aid centre in Kirkuk in northern Iraq, and is also a contact point for families trying to trace relatives.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Malcolm Grieve now continues with his reading of Cider with Rosie.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. The kitchen in which we lived, worn by our boots and lives, was scruffy, warm and low. whose fuss of furniture seemed never the same, but was shuffled around each day. A black grate crackled with coal and beech twigs. Towels toasted on the guard. The mantel was littered with fine old china horse brasses and freak potatoes. There were six tables of different sizes, some armchairs gapingly stuffed, boxes, stools, and unravelling baskets, books and papers on every chair, sofa for cats, a harmonium for coats, and a piano for dust and photographs. These were the shapes of our kitchen landscape, the rocks of our submarine life. Each object worn smooth by a constant nuzzling, or encrusted by lively barnacles, relics of birthdays and dead relations, wrecks of furniture long since foundered, all silted deep by mother's newspapers which the years piled round on the floor. Waking up in the morning, I saw squirrels in the yew trees nibbling at the moist red berries. Between the trees and the window hung a cloud of gold air, composed of floating seeds and spiders. Farmers called to their cows on the other side of the valley, and moorhens piped from the ponds. Brother Jack, as always, was the first to move, while I pulled on my boots in bed. We both stood at last on the bare wood floor, scratching and saying our prayers. Too stiff and manly to say them out loud, we stood back to back and muttered them. Walking downstairs, there was a smell of floorboards, of rags, sour lemons and spices. The smoky kitchen was in its morning muddle, from which breakfast would presently emerge. "I'm all behind," said Mother to the fire. "This wretched coal's all slack." She snatched up an oil can and threw it all on the fire. A belch of flame roared up the chimney. Mother gave a loud scream, as she always did, and went on stirring the porridge. "If I had a proper stove," she said, "it's a trial getting you off each day." How different again looked the kitchen this morning, swirling with smoke and sunlight. Some cut-glass vases threw jagged rainbows across the piano's field of dust, while Father in his pince-nez up on the wall looked down like a scandalized god. The girls round the table chewed moonishly, wrapped in their morning stupor. "Golly," cried Doff, "have you seen the time?" They began to jump to their feet. "Goodness, it's late. I got to be off. Me too. Lord, where's my things?" They hitched up their stockings, patted their hats, and went running up the bank. This was the hour when walkers and bicyclists flowed down the long hills to Stroud, where the hooters called for the morning dews and factories puffed out their plumes. From each crooked corner of Stroud's five valleys, girls were running to shops and looms, with sleep in their eyes and eggy cheeks, and in their ears night voices fading. As for Harold, he'd started work already. His day began at 6, when he'd leave the house with an angry shout for the lathe work he loved. If it was school time, he pushed off next. If not, we dodged up the bank to play, ran snail races along the walls, or dug in the garden, and found potatoes and cooked them in tins on the rubbish heap. But holiday mornings were a time of risk. There might be housework or errands to do. So if we hung around the yard, we kept our ears cocked. If she caught us, the game was up. "Ah, there you are, son. I'm needing some salt. Pop up to Vic's for a lump, there's a dear. See if Granny Trill's got a screw of tea. Only ask her nicely, mind. Run up to Miss Turk. Try and borrow 1/2 crown. I didn't know I got so low. Ask our Jack, Mother. I borrowed the bacon. It's blooming well his turn now." But Jack had slid off like an eel through the grass, making his sly getaway as usual. He was jumpy, shifty, and quick off the mark, an electric flex of nerves, skinny compared with the rest of us, or what farmers might call a poor doer. If they had, in fact, they would have been quite wrong, for Jack did himself very well. He had developed a mealtime strategy which ensured that he ate for two, and we hungry ones called him the slider. Starving Jack had worked it all out. He followed the spoon with his plate. Absent-mindedly, Mother would give him the first dollop, and very often a second, and as soon as he got it, he swallowed it whole, not using his teeth at all. "More, please, I've finished." The bare plate proved it, so he got the pot scrapings too. Many the race I've lost to him thus, being just that second slower. When evening came, we returned to the kitchen, back to its smoky comfort, in from the rapidly cooling air to its wrappings of warmth and cooking. A plate of blue smoke hung above our chimney flat, in the motionless air. The The baker came down with a basket of bread slung carelessly over his shoulder. 8 quartern loaves, cottage-size, black-crusted, were handed in at the door. We lit the candles and set them about, each in its proper order. Their flames pushed weakly against the red of the fire, too tenuous to make much headway, revealing our faces more by casts of darkness than by any clear light they threw. Meanwhile, Jack had cleared some boots from the table and started his inscrutable homework. Tony, in his corner, was playing with some cotton reels, pushing them slowly round the table. All was silent, except Tony's voice, softly muttering his cotton reel story. "So they came up with this big hole, see, and the big chap said fire, and said we'll kill him, see, and the pirates was waiting up here, and they had this girt cannon, and he went, bang, fire, and the big chap went down, whee, and rolled back in the hole, and I said to him, we run up the hill, and this boat was coming, see, and I jumped on board, whoosh, crump, and I said, now I'm captain, see, and they said, fire, and I took me hatchet, ack, ack, and they all fell plop in the sea, wallop. And I sailed the boat round here, and up here, and round here, and down here, and round here, and up here, and down here. Now the girls arrived home in their belted mackintoshes, flushed from their walk through the dark. We talked in spurts, in lowered voices, scarcely noticing if anybody answered. "We turned a shaft a thou today," said Harold. "A what?" "He said a thou." Chairs creaked a while as we thought about it. "Charlie Revel's got a brand new suit. He had it made to fit. He half fancies himself. Look, Doth, I got these bits for 6 months. I'm going to stitch them all round the top here." Well, it's all right. Dr. Green came up the shop this morning, wearing corduroy bloomers. Laugh. "Look, Ma, look, I've drawn a church on fire. Look, Marge, Doff, hey, look." "If X equals X, then Y equals Z." "Shut up! If X is Y..." "You know that boy from the dairy, Marge? The one they call Barnacle Boots? Well, he asked me to go to spots with him. I told him to run off home." "No, you never." "I certainly did. I said I don't go to no pictures with butter wallopers. You should have seen his face." "And I sailed the boat round here, and up here, and round here, and down here, and round here, and up here, and down here." The fire burned clear with a bottle-green light. Their voices grew low and furry. A farm dog barked far across the valley, fixing the time and distance exactly. I could sense the night valley emptying, stretching in mists of stars and water, growing slowly more secret and late. My pencil began to wander on the page. I thought I'd stretch myself on the sofa for a while, for a short while only. The boards on the ceiling were melting like water. Words broke and went floating away. Chords of smooth music surged in my head. Thick tides of warmth overwhelmed me. I was drowning in languors of feathered seas, spiralling cosily down. The whispering girls bent over me. "Wake up, lamb. He's whacked to the wide. Let's try and carry him up."
That was Malcolm Greaves reading Cider with Rosie. He has a voice like honey. It's excellent to listen to. Bristol recently hosted an international poetry festival just last week, and our reporter Anthea Page was at the Arnold Feeney to interview two of South Africa's celebrated poets, Rustam Kozein and Gbaba Badaroon, about the poetry and the point of poetry in South Africa today.
I'm at the Poetry Fest at the Arnold Feeney, and I'm talking to
Gbaba Badaroon.
And you're going to tell us about the point of, well, your talk today is about the point of poetry in South Africa. But you're going to talk a little bit about the poetry scene in South Africa, is that right?
That's right, yes. It's particularly a vibrant scene at the moment, and I was lucky enough to be talking to Rustam Kozein, who's probably the best of the current generation of poets in South Africa. He's in his early 40s, and he's been writing for the past 20 years or so and produced probably the best debut collection that's been published in the last 10 years or so. And so it was very exciting to be talking about the poetry scene in South Africa with him today. And I think we talked about some of the expected themes, such as, is there a great difference between post-apartheid and apartheid-era poetry? And we talked about the fact that it's in a particularly vibrant period right now in terms of the visibility of poetry, in South Africa, the numbers of books that are being published, the numbers of books that are being bought, the poetry festival. So it's an interesting and maturing scene.
Yeah.
That it's based on a relatively small book buying public. So these are some of the challenges. And also that, you know, as Rustin pointed out during the discussion, that in a way the poetry buying public is the end point of a long process that starts with a good education system. And that remains a huge challenge for us. So if we're thinking about the future of this vibrant period in South African poetry, we're also talking about the fundamentals, not only the glamour and the prizes and the festival.
Yeah, but wasn't there... what I picked up was that perhaps there's more literature being written in many different languages. When people talk about South Africa, I always think of everything being done in English. Was that how it was before, that the literary people wrote in English? But now everyone can. There's more expansion of language and availability to express yourself in a...
Well, not to a large extent. I mean, the thing is, South Africa's always had a strong literary culture in both English and in Afrikaans. But, you know, those were the two dominant languages because the people who controlled South Africa were basically Afrikaans and English-speaking. In terms of other African languages as such, you know, the publication in those languages were limited basically to people writing folklorish stories for school textbooks, you know, for ethnically based school textbooks. There may be a freeing up of that happening now, but there isn't the infrastructure, there isn't the publishing houses, the newspapers and journals to review literature that English and Afrikaans has had, you know, since Thomas Pringle first started publishing in South Africa. So while there's a political opening up, there isn't the economic resources. So, you know, a few titles in African languages are now being published, but it doesn't have the vast machine of English and of the English and Afrikaans establishments behind it to kind of promote it.
Mm. You know? But on the other hand, certainly the performance poetry and the oral poetry are in many more languages, and the audiences for those are growing.
So what effect do you think politics or uprisings have had on poetry? Because we have featured Soweto poets, mm-hmm. and it seemed that after all the troubles in Soweto, that did inspire people mm-hmm. to write poetry. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's still happening now to a degree or not?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as I pointed out earlier on, that there is a radical politics that one can find in a lot of poetry in South Africa, but it doesn't have the visibility that something like, you know, the generation from the 70s, for instance, did have. Okay, and part of that has got to do with the way in which a focus has shifted, that there has been, you know, there's been an acceptance that the ANC government is a good government, that the political priorities in literature have kind of shifted, okay? And what is interesting for me is that, on the contrary, you know, the kind of mild political engagement you get in prose and in fiction, you know, has a kind of counterbalance or counterweight in quite a lot of poetry that is being published, but it's not published in easily visible or easily accessible publications, for instance. So there's a strong tradition of politics still evident in South African poetry.
Could you tell us a little bit about the poet laureate? Because he's a friend of yours, I believe.
Yes, his name is Kira Petsi Hositsile, and he was in exile for many years in other parts of Africa and in the United States. And he returned to South Africa in the 1990s and has been a presence in the arts world and in arts journalism since then. He is, or has been also currently, an advisor to the Minister of Arts and Culture. And in that position, I think, has been responsible for some quite interesting initiatives which have raised the visibility of literature and helped to fund some new magazines that are literary journals, which otherwise might not be sustained because, you know, the audience that buys such magazines is very small. The laureateship is a recently instituted position, and Kyropetsi Khosiksile is the second holder of that that laureateship. He was selected by a jury of a committee of literary scholars. And in the position, I mean, since it's a new position, in a way we're still inventing what the laureateship actually means. You know, what does a poet laureate do?
And is it based on the English model?
I don't know, because I wasn't... Well,
post the special occasions.
No,
yeah,
he doesn't do that.
It doesn't do that, but what I find interesting about the laureateship is that there is, again, there's a social component. There's a requirement that the laureate actually do active work in promoting literacy and a literary culture. So one of the things that he's done, for instance, he's taken a lot of very young, new African writers, black African writers, you know, on literary jaunts all over the world. There was one in Cuba, for instance. So, you know, it's introducing younger writers into a kind of internationalist culture, which is always valuable.
So it's making poetry accessible to young people.
And so the younger writers, for instance, would have to conduct workshops or lead workshops in Ghana or in Cuba and back in South Africa as well. So, you know, I think that's a very interesting part of the laureate, that the laureate is not, as in America or in Britain, you know, write the occasional verse in celebration of you know, some public or government figure, etc., etc.
One thing you mentioned was the libraries, that poetry festivals were, the money raised was helping to provide libraries for farm workers' children. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good cause, isn't it? To bring literature to the poorer people.
Yeah, it's one particular instance of it, that there's one literary festival in a small town in the Winelands. Mm-hmm. Which has as its explicit and primary aim to raise funds to build a public library in the town.
This is the Franschhoek Literary Festival, which takes place in May every year. Mm-hmm. And just as it, you know, has a social component, many other literature festivals in South Africa also have components which, for instance, include literacy and creative writing workshops for school children, sometimes for people who are in prisons. So I think the idea that literature is socially embedded is something that we've carried forth from the days of the anti-apartheid struggle, where poetry was very visibly playing that role. It also plays, of course, many, many other roles, even in that era. But certainly the social component of such literature festivals is very strong.
So... Are children now, do they have more access to education generally? Is it improving in South Africa? I think this is what people are interested in. What is the situation like for the poorer people?
It's very difficult because, you know, in terms of legislation and in terms of politics, you know, the South African education system is now an open system, so it's not racially defined anymore, okay? But because of the history, the resource allocation is still very unequal in a way, you know. So if you are born poor, then you know the chances are 100% that you're going to have a poor education. You know, and the thing is that, you know, there is a very important argument about the legacy of apartheid that people often want to dismiss, you know, that people want to say, well, you know, the ANC government has been in power now for 15 years, it's time to move on, you can't blame apartheid for all sorts of social woes. But you have to, because, you know, that history runs so deep. Mm. And it is unfortunate that the ANC government hasn't been able to respond to something like education and resource allocation, you know, which is one of my primary critiques of the ANC government. But yeah, it's still very unequal.
Right, and again, you know, it's a legacy of 40 years of very uneven resource allocation, but also that followed hundreds of years of very unequal resource allocation during the colonial era.
It's not going to happen overnight, is it?
It can't, but on the other hand, the priorities could be set.
Yeah.
And, you know, both Russell and I agree that an investment in an education system that produces a lively, intellectually curious and artistically conscious population and citizenry is crucial, and you know that more needs to be done to fulfill that priority.
There's a lot to be said about education. I mean, there are massive problems in education, you know, and we could probably talk for hours and hours about what the problems are, what possible solutions are, what the government's response has been, etc., etc. And it's you know, I mean, it's really sad. You know, because I've, you know, in my own life, education has been a very empowering tool, you know, and I've used education as a form of self-empowerment.
Mm.
And that is what the tragedy is, that, you know, in neglecting
There's
the
a lot
education.
Of clever people who are out there in South Africa who will never get the chance to fulfill their potential.
That's right. Well, but if you're middle class, if you're middle class, for instance, and, you know, your parents can afford it, then you can get access to pretty decent education, irrespective of what your skin colour is.
So tonight you'll be reading some of your poetry. Mm-hmm. Is it possible for anyone to access your poetry on the internet? Can they read your poetry or find out more about it?
Yeah,
do you have a website?
Yes, I have, and Rustam also has his own website, www.kozain.com. KOZAIN.com, and I'm at habiba.com, that's GABEBA.com. And you know, one of the interesting things about South African literature at the moment is that it's very technologically savvy. So there are blogs and there are lots of literary journals, good ones, that are based on the internet. So, you know, Google South African literature and you'll find book.co.za, litnet.co.za. There's some extremely interesting debates and excellent literature that's there.
Oh, well, perhaps we'll read some of your poetry on our show in the next few weeks.
I hope so.
Oh, that would be quite encouraging.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Rustam Kozain and Gbaba Badaroon talking about South African poetry at the Ardelfini in the recent International Poetry Festival in Bristol.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Time to hear Tony Gosling reading part 7 of The History of Theatre in Bristol, and now it's the period World War I.
A man came to me at a fair and said, "If you've a poet's tongue, tumble up and chant the air that the stars of the morning sung. I'll pay for you if you sing it nice a penny piece." I answered flat, "Sixpence is the proper price for a ballad such as that." The story of the Bristol stage from 1490 to 1925, serialised in 9 parts from the book of the same name by Miss M. Board. Part 7, Bristol's Theatre During World War I. That marvellous artist Anna Pavlova came with a full company of Russian dancers to Bristol. We feel that something from the years before time has arrived with these dancers. Primitive is a word robbed of its meaning by continual use, yet these seem primeval. The spirit of motion, unperceived, unknown, in the twilight of our beginnings, animates them. That they are just men and women does not express the emotion their dance creates. We seem on the verge of a revelation of a beauty that's unknown, but not unperceived. They haunt our memory, as do primeval things. There is another interesting fact about Bristol houses to notice. George Alexander was at Dr. Benham's school on St. Michael's Hill, and afterwards finished his school education at Clifton College. This year came to Bristol Seymour Hicks and Elaine Terrace. Of all the dates that are bitten into the memory of our generation, there is none like 1914, and it brought with it a bitter blow on the stage, though paradoxically it also brought a tremendous revival in art, the love and the making of poetry, which is the primitive expression of our souls, the love of the stage, in fact, that urgent need to see and express the truth in everything. Eliza Comes to Stay, that delightful play, came with Eva Moore and H.V. Esmond. As a playwright, Arnold Bennett is unsurpassed for humour and the delight that he gives. Sheil Barry bought his play The Great Adventure. In the years that followed, many famous names were associated with the Prince's Theatre, such as Miss Gertrude Elliot, Mattison Lang, Miss Sidney Fairbrother, Mrs. Patrick Campbell, Miss Edna May, Miss Marie Tempest, Lewis Waller, Charles Hawtrey, Miss Madge Titheridge, Oscar Ashe, Miss Lily Brayton, Miss Pauline Chase, Lena Ashwell and Edward Terry. One of the most delightful weeks was when Miss Gertrude Elliot brought Come Out of the Kitchen. It's a delight to see acting like Miss Elliot's with its perfect technique. The last time I was at Prince's Theatre, it was as the guest of Mrs. Chute, to see Ivor Novello in his play The Rat. He made a charming little speech in which he claimed Bristol for his own and reminded the audience that he was one of the pages at Clara Butt's wedding. It speaks much for the popularity of the management when it's true to say that the play seems incomplete unless Mrs. Chute, a charming presence, is in her box watching the performance. Another theatrical activity has taken place during the years of Prince's Theatre's history, but, for the sake of continuity, reference to them has been withheld from the text until now. Garrick said of Shakespeare, "The more you read him, the better you will like him, and the better you will play him." Certainly no greater pleasure can be imagined than a Shakespearean play well acted. Childish impressions are indelible, and I shall always be thankful that I spent so many hours at the Zoological Gardens in my childhood, watching Mr. Ben Greet's company play Shakespeare's pastoral plays. It was wonderful. It opened a world of delight, rich and coloured and glorious. Picture Midsummer Night's Dream, and overhead the thick trees waving and above the sky. The rich words of Shakespeare borne on the softly lapping breeze. It gave the audience a love of the immortal poet that could not be destroyed by years. Mr. Ben Greet has given Bristol a lovely memory to keep. That was part 7 of the story of the Bristol Stage, 1490 to 1925, by Miss M. Board. Next week is part 8. Will the old Vic be sold to build a bacon factory? The Avon Association of Drama covers the Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire areas and publishes Prompt magazine 10 times a year. Other activities include festivals, playwriting, open air and touring productions, publicity and training. Individual membership and subscription to Prompt is £10 a year, and the Avon Association of Drama's website is at avondrama.co.uk. Mark Graves is the subscription secretary on 01454 238 384.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
That's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre, right by Queen Square. Thank you to Martin Summers for his piece regarding the credit crunch, and Matt Heap for giving us his own personal muses. Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of Sided with Rosie, to be continued next week. Tony Gosling interviewed Sammy Veliola, and Anthea Page gave us the Poetry Festival piece. Our coiffured Hellenic beauty Jeff Sparks was away this week in Great Yarmouth, communing with remote fen dwellers, possibly using ancient runic languages. But he'll be back with us next week for another instalment of What's On Around Bristol. Villis Church Curran was the studio engineer, and this week's show was produced by Anthea Page, and the studio director was Matt Heap. Last but not least, I'm going to very briefly plug Amnesty International, because they were kind enough to send somebody in to do an interview a couple of weeks ago. They meet every month at the youth hostel next to the Arnold Feeney down in town, and it's on the third Monday of every month at around 8 p.m. And soon coming up on the 10th of December is the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights as laid down by the UN and ignored by various brutalist regimes around the world. And the Amnesty International will be doing lots of festivities for that of one kind or another, so check the website for details and go along to their meeting. You can download our show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. So that's goodbye from all of us here at Dialect Radio, goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Until next week, goodbye.